again and again, amazed that his fingers were capable of anything so delicate. He liked the mornings when he braided Adele's hair. She only allowed him to because she was forgetting, and he could forget, too, that she wasn't his mother.
"You warm enough there, Miss Adele?"
he asked. She nodded, gathering her sweater closer.
"Desiree said you like going fishing," he said. "That true?"
"Desiree say that?"
"Yes'm. I told her we find her some fish to fry up tonight. Sound good, don't it?"
She stared up at the trees, wringing her hands.
"I ought to be getting to work myself," Adele said.
"No, ma'am. You got the day off."
"The whole day?"
She was so surprised and delighted by the idea that he didn't have the heart to tell her that she hadn't gone to work in the past 9 months. The white folks she cleaned for had been the first to notice her lapse in memory. Dishes ending up in the wrong drawers, laundry folded before it dried, canned beans chilled in the refrigerator while chicken rotted on the pantry shelf.
"Oh, I'm old," she'd said. "You know how it is. You just start forgetting things."
But Dr. Brenner said that it was Alzheimer's and it would only get worse. Desiree cried on the phone when she called to tell early. He cut a job in Lawrence short to be with her. It'd be all right, he'd told her, rocking her, even though he couldn't think of anything more terrifying than looking into Desiree's face one day and only seeing a stranger.
"Are you my son?"
Adele asked. He smiled, reaching for his fishing rod.
"No, ma'am," he said.
"No,"
she repeated.
"I don't have any sons."
She turned, satisfied, to the trees, as if he'd just helped her solve a riddle that was troubling her. Then she glanced at him again, almost shyly.
"You're not my husband, are you?"
"No, ma'am."
"I don't have one of those neither."
"I'm just your Early," he said. "That's all I am."
"Early?"
She laughed suddenly.
"What type of fool name is that?"
"The only fool name I got."
"I know who you are," she said.
"You that farm boy, always hanging around Desiree."
He touched the end of her gray braid.
"That's right," he said. "That's exactly right."
When they returned to the house, there was a white woman sitting on the porch. Early had caught two small speckled trout, delighting Adele, who'd watched them wriggle on his line. Now, heading back home, Adele humming, her arm looped through his, he spotted the white woman through the clearing and gripped her arm tighter. Once a woman from the county came by to check on Adele. Desiree was humiliated, some strange white woman wandering around her house to make sure that the living conditions were suitable.
"Must be suitable enough," she told Early. "She been living here 60 years.
He hated the thought of government workers poking around, as if the two of them were not capable of looking after one forgetting woman. But the visits came with the assistants. They needed money for the medicines, the doctor visits, the bills. Still, he wasn't too thrilled about meeting the county woman. No surprise what she'd think of him. He patted Adele's hand.
"If that lady asks, we'll tell her I'm your son-in-law," he said.
"What you talking about?"
"That white lady on the porch," he said, "from the county. Just to make it all go down easier."
She pulled away.
"Quit fooling," she said. "That ain't no white woman. That's just Stella."
In all the years he'd hunted Stella, imagined her, dreamed about her, she'd become larger in his eyes. She was smarter than him, clever, twisting away each time he drew near. But this not white woman, this Stella Veens, looked so ordinary, he lost his breath. Not like Desiree, He wouldn't have confused the two even as he drew closer, Stella clambering to her feet. She wore navy blue slacks and leather boots, her hair pinned into a ponytail. Pitch black, like she hadn't aged at all, unlike Desiree, whose temples began to streak silver. It wasn't just her clothes, though, but the way she held her body. Taut, like a guitar string wound around itself. She looked scared. But of what? Of him? Well, maybe she ought to be. He wanted to rage at her for every night Desiree fell asleep thinking of her, not him. But Stella wasn't looking at him. She was staring at her mother, her mouth open like a trout gasping for breath. Adele barely glanced at her.
Girl, come help us clean those fishes, Adele said. And go get your sister.
Her mother had lost her mind. Stella realized this slowly as she followed her down the narrow hallway to the kitchen where a strange man unloaded fish from an icebox. All the times she'd imagined what her mother might say if she came home, she would be angry, might even slap her across the face. She'd never pictured this. Her mother, a shell of herself, bustling around the kitchen as if the only thing on her mind were fixing dinner. As indifferent to Stella as if she'd been gone 25 minutes, not years. The strange man following after her, picking up a knife after she'd set it down, keeping her away from the stove, finally convincing her to have a seat at the table while he made her a cup of coffee.
Are you Desiree's husband? Stella asked.
He let out a low laugh.
Something like that. Well, who are you then? What are you doing with my mother? Why are you acting like that, Stella?
Her mother said, handing her a spoon.
You know this your brother.
He couldn't be the dark girl's father. He wasn't nearly as black as her, even though he looked grizzled and tough, like the type of man who might bully a woman.
How long has it been like this? She said.
Yeah, maybe.
Jesus. Girl, don't take the Lord's name in vain,
her mother said.
I raised you better than that. I'm sorry, Mama, she said quickly. Mama, I'm so sorry. I don't know what you're talking about, her mother said. Probably don't need to know. Start working on that fish.
Her daddy had taught her how to gut a fish. She'd trounced alongside him in the river, water splashing up to her knees. Desiree marching up ahead, stomping so loud, Daddy said that she'd scare all the fish away. They were his twin sprites, following him through the woods. The fishing part always bored Desiree. She wandered off, sprawling on her stomach somewhere, making daisy chains. But Stella could sit with him for hours, so still, imagining that she could see through the murky water to every living thing swirling around her bare toes. After, he showed the twins how to clean the fish he'd caught. Lay it flat, slide the knife inside the belly, and then what? She couldn't remember. She wanted to cry.
I don't know how, she said. You just don't like getting your hands dirty, her mother said. Desiree!
She had work, Miss Adele,
the man said.
Work?
Over in town.
Well, somebody ought to get her. She's going to miss supper.
Stella'll fetch her,
the man said.
I'm going to stay right here with you.
He wrapped an arm around her mother's shoulders, protectively. Protecting her from me, Stella realized, gently setting down the knife. She stepped out onto the front porch and stared into the woods. She did not realize until she was walking through the dirt that she had no idea where she was going. The first thing to know about the reunion, as it would later be called, is that there were no real witnesses. Lou's egg house was always empty between lunch and dinner, which was when Jude phoned from the student union. Desiree loved those noisy calls, even though Jude always sounded harried, rushing off to a lecture or a lab. That afternoon, she was trying to coax Desiree to visit her again.
"You know I can't," Desiree said.
"I know," Jude said. "I just miss you. I worry about you sometimes." Desiree swallowed.
"Well, don't," she said. "You out there living your life. That's all I want for you. Don't you worry about me. Mama'll be all right."
She didn't hear the bell jingle over the door until after she hung up the phone. It surprised her. The diner had been empty when she'd stepped into the back to answer the phone, except for Marvin Landry, who was never sober past noon, the war having done him. And that afternoon in particular, he was slumped in a back booth, a fifth of whiskey inside his jacket. He hadn't touched the turkey sandwich Desiree had left in front of him. He didn't even wake up when Stella Veen stepped inside. He didn't see her pause in the doorway, glancing around at the peeling linoleum floors, the bursting leather stools, the bum snoozing in the corner. Didn't hear Desiree call from the back, "Be right out." He certainly didn't see Desiree backing out of the kitchen, retying her apron. She didn't notice him at all, because when she turned around, she was staring at Stella.
"Oh,"
Desiree said. That was all she could think to say. "Oh." Less a word than a sound. She dropped her apron strings, the garment flapping uselessly against her. Across the counter, Stella was smiling, but her eyes filled with tears. She stepped toward her, but Desiree held up a hand.
"Don't,"
she said, choking back anger. Stella standing in front of her, appearing with no warning, no apologies, returning only after Desiree had finally let her go, wearing that blouse that she would sometimes remember as the color of cream, other times the color of bone, a blouse that looked like it had never stained or wrinkled. Tiny pearl buttons, a shiny silver bracelet, no wedding ring, her hands tightening into fists, the way they curled sometimes when Stella was nervous. And she was nervous now, wasn't she? She had never been nervous around Desiree before. But why shouldn't she be? All those years, what had given her the nerve to show her face again, to expect that she might be welcomed? Desiree's thoughts ran jumbled through her head. She could barely follow them. And Stella's smile faded, but she still took another tiny step closer.
"I mean it," Desiree said, her voice low, threatening.
"Forgive me," Stella said. "Forgive me." She was still repeating those words when she walked around the counter. Desiree tried to push her away, but Stella pulled, and then they were struggling. And then they were holding each other. Desiree exhausted, whimpering, Stella begging for forgiveness into her sister's hair. And that's what Marvin Landry told everyone he saw when he finally woke up, a turkey sandwich resting on a plate in front of him, and a misted bottle of Coke. And behind the counter, Desiree Veen's wrapped around herself. She's different now. The same words passed through each twin's mind. Desiree eyeing how Stella held her knife and fork, barely gripping the metal. Stella noticing how boldly Desiree moved around the kitchen now. Desiree watching Stella rub the back of her neck, a gesture that seemed so wearied it startled her. Stella listening to Desiree speak to their mother, her voice soft and soothing. And all the while, to Adele Veen's, the twins were the same as they'd ever been. Time was collapsing and expanding. The twins were different and the same all at once. There could have been 50 pairs of twins sitting at that dinner table, a seat for each person they had been since they'd spoken last. A battered wife and a bored one, a waitress and a professor, each woman seated next to a stranger. Instead, there were only the twins, Early sitting between them. He felt, watching Stella primly cut her fish, that he didn't know Desiree at all, that maybe it was impossible to know one without the other. After dinner, he cleared the dishes while the twins stepped out onto the front porch, Desiree carrying a dusty bottle of gin that she'd found in the back of the pantry. She'd brought it out even though she didn't know if Stella even liked gin, but Stella's eyes drifted to the bottle, then back to hers, and Desiree felt the thrill of a silent conversation. She smuggled it outside, Stella trailing after her.
"Don't y'all stay out too late," their mother called. "It's a school night."
Now they passed the bottle lazily between them, wincing through sips of that ancient gin, which had been a wedding gift from Marie Veen's. The DeCures had been scandalized. What a present from your mother-in-law. And somehow the controversial bottle had been forgotten over the years. Desiree sipped, then Stella, the twins falling into an easy rhythm.
"You talk different now," Desiree said.
"What do you mean?"
Stella said.
"Like that."
"What do you mean? How'd you learn to talk like that?"
Stella paused and smiled.
"Television," she said. "I used to watch hours of it just to learn how to sound like them."
"Jesus," Desiree said.
"I still can't believe you did it, Stella. It isn't so hard.
You could have done it. You didn't want me to. You left me."
God, Desiree hated how wounded she sounded. After all these years, whining like a child abandoned on the play yard.
"It wasn't that," Stella said. "I met someone."
"You did all this for a man?"
"Not for him," she said. "I just liked who I was with him."
"White?"
"No," Stella said. "Free."
Desiree laughed.
"Same thing, baby."
She took another sip of gin, swallowing hard.
"Well, who was he?"
Again, Stella paused.
"Mr. Sanders," she finally said.
In spite of everything, Desiree laughed. She laughed harder than she had in weeks, years even. Laughed until Stella, laughing too, snatched the bottle out of her hands before she knocked it over.
"Mr. Sanders," she said, "that old boss of yours, you ran off with him?"
Farrah said.
"Farrah Thibodeau. I haven't thought about her in years."
"She said she seen you with a man."
"Whatever happened to her?"
"I don't know. This was years ago. She married some alderman."
"A politician's wife.
Can you believe it?"
The twins, laughing, talking over each other again, churning their way through that bottle. Desiree looking out for their mother, the way she'd done when they were teenagers smoking on the porch. She was a little drunk by now. She didn't even know how late it was.
"How'd you do it?" she said. "All those years."
"I had to keep going," Stella said.
"You can't turn back when you have a family. When you have people that depend on you."
"You had a family," Desiree said.
"Oh, that's not what I mean,"
Stella said, looking away.
"It's different with a child.
You know that."
But what was different exactly? A sister easier to shed than a daughter? A mother than a husband? What made her so easy to give away? But she didn't ask this, of course. She would have felt even more like a child than she already did, glancing over her shoulder to make sure her mother didn't catch her drinking.
"So, it's you and Mr. Sanders."
"Blake."
"You and Blake and..."
"We have a daughter,"
Stella said. "Kennedy." Desiree tried to imagine her. For some reason, she could only envision a proper little white girl posed on a piano bench,
her hands folded on her lap just so. "So what's she like?" Desiree said. "Your girl."
"Willful, charming. She's an actor."
"An actor?"
"She does little plays in New York, not Broadway or anything."
"Still," Desiree said, "an actor. Maybe you can bring her next time."
She knew she'd said the wrong thing when Stella glanced away. A tiny look, but one that Desiree could still read. When their eyes met again, Stella's were full of tears. "You know I can't," she said.
"Why not?"
"Your daughter."
"What about her?"
"She found me, Desiree, in Los Angeles. That's why I'm here."
Desiree scoffed.
How could Jude have found Stella? Her daughter, a college student, stumbling upon her in a city as large as Los Angeles. And even if she had somehow found Stella, her daughter would have told her. She never would have kept a secret like that from her.
"She didn't tell you,"
Stella said. "I don't blame her. I was awful. I didn't mean to be. I was scared. Some girl showing up out of nowhere, saying she knows me. She looks nothing like you, you know that. What was I supposed to think? But she found my daughter, told all about me, about Mallard. Then she pops up again in New York."
Desiree pushed off the porch step. She had to call Jude. She didn't care that it was late, that she was tipsy, that Stella was miraculously sitting on her front porch. But Stella grabbed her wrist.
"Desiree, please," she said. "Just listen to me. Just be reasonable."
"I've been reasonable."
"She'll never stop. Your girl will keep trying to tell mine the truth, and it's too late for all that now. Can't you see that?"
"Oh, sure. It's the end of the world. Your girl finding out she ain't so lily white."
"That I lied to her," Stella said. "She'll never forgive me. You don't understand, Desiree. You're a good mother. I can see that. Your girl loves you. That's why she didn't tell you about me. But I haven't been a good one. I spent so long hiding."
"Because you chose to. You wanted to."
"I know," Stella said. "I know, but please, please, Desiree, don't take her away from me."
She bent over, crying into her hands, and exhausted, Desiree returned to the step beside her. She wrapped an arm around Stella's shoulders, staring at the nape of her neck, pretending not to see the gray hair threading through the black. She'd always felt like the older sister, even though she only was by a matter of minutes. But maybe in those 7 minutes they'd first been apart, they'd each lived a lifetime, setting out on their separate paths, each discovering who she might be. In the beginning, Early Jones could never fall asleep in the Veins' house. The comfort disturbed him. He was used to sleeping under the stars, or cramped in his car, or lying on a hard prison cot. Or before all that, piled on a mattress stuffed with Spanish moss beside 8 of his siblings, whose names he no longer remembered, let alone their faces. He was not used to this. A big bed and homemade quilt, the headboard carved by a man nobody talked about, but who lingered still in all the furniture. At first, he would lie in bed beside Desiree, under a roof that did not leak, and chase hopelessly after sleep. Sometimes he ended up pacing in front, smoking cigarettes at 3 in the morning, feeling as if the house itself had rejected him. Other times, he fell asleep on the porch and didn't wake up until Desiree tripped over him the next morning.
"He's like a wild dog," he'd heard Adele tell her. "You give him a nice bed, he still feel better sleeping in the dirt."
She wasn't wrong. He was a hunter, after all. He wasn't built for soft quilts and roomy chairs. He only felt like himself with his nose pressed to the trail.
which was why, the next morning, when he heard Stella sneaking out the front door, he followed her outside.
"Mighty early for the train," he said.
She jolted, almost dropping her little bag. She looked shamed that he'd caught her.
"I have to get back home," she said.
"Ain't right to leave like this," he said, "without saying goodbye."
"It's the only way," she said. "If I have to tell her goodbye, I'll never leave. And I have to. I have to go back to my life."
He understood. In spite of himself, he did. Maybe that was the only way his parents could have dumped him. If they told him goodbye, he would have hollered, clinging to their legs. He would have never let them go.
"You need a ride," he said.
She glanced toward the dark woods and nodded. He led Stella to his car. He offered to drive her, not out of kindness, but because Desiree loved Stella. And that was how love worked, wasn't it? A transference, leaping onto you if you inched close enough. He drove Stella past the bus stop, all the way to the train station. She sat in the front seat of his beat-up ride, both hands clutching the bag in her lap.
"I never meant it to be this way," she said.
He grunted. He didn't want to look at her as she climbed out of his car. He didn't want to be the only one to tell her goodbye. He already knew then that he would lie to Desiree when he came home, pretend he hadn't heard Stella inching across the hall. The same way he knew when Stella slid her wedding ring into his palm that he would never tell Desiree about it.
"Sell it," she said, not looking at him. "Take care, Mama."
He tried to hand the ring back to her, but by then, Stella was climbing out of his car, Stella walking into the train station, Stella disappearing behind the glass doors. That diamond ring felt cold in his palm. He had no idea what something like that could be worth, and he wouldn't know for sure until weeks later when he had it appraised. That bald white man staring at it through his magnifying glass, gazing back at Early wearily, and asking how he came by the ring again. "Passed down through the family," Early told him. Like most truths, it sounded a little phony. When Desiree woke that morning, she reached across the bed and felt nothing but air. She wasn't surprised, but she still cried out, touching the empty space across the bed. The night before, she had fallen asleep across from her sister. Two women squeezed onto a bed that was far too small. Stella in her old spot, Desiree in the place she'd slept for years. For hours, they stayed up, whispering in the dark until their vision blurred, neither wanting to be the first to close her eyes. A month after Stella returned to Mallard, her daughter finally called home and announced that she was moving back to California. Her thing with France, and wasn't it just like her to call a serious relationship a thing, had run its course. She'd spent all her money in Europe. Her heart wasn't in musical theater anymore. She offered up a few different excuses, but Stella, listening, her heart in her throat, didn't care why. She didn't even care that her daughter hadn't said that she wanted to be close to her parents, that she missed them. She had gone home, and now her daughter was coming home too. The two events were unconnected, of course, but in her mind she bound them together, one return triggering the other. She canceled her afternoon class to meet Kennedy outside LAX. And there she was, walking through the terminal, lugging a bulging suitcase. She was thinner now, and she'd cut her hair, blonde waves falling halfway down her neck. Stella pulled her into a hug, holding on to her for so long that the others waiting at the baggage carousel stared.
"Are you okay?" her daughter asked. "You look different."
"Different how?"
"I don't know. Tired?"
She'd spent the past month unable to sleep through the night. Each time she closed her eyes, she saw Desiree.
"I'm fine," she said, grabbing Kennedy's hand. "I'm just so glad you're back."
"What happened to your ring?" her daughter said.
She almost lied.
It scared her how natural lying was. She almost told her daughter the same story she'd told Blake when she came home, barehanded for the first time in 20-odd years. How she'd taken off her ring at work to wash her hands. How she must have left it in the soap dish in the faculty bathroom. How she had hounded every janitor she could find, but none could locate it. She'd seemed so distraught that he ended up comforting her.
"Oh, it's all right, Stell," he said. "I think you're due for an upgrade anyway."
He was having the new ring custom made at her favorite jeweler. A lie procuring the first ring, a different one procuring the second. She could never be completely honest with her husband, but somehow, standing in the airport, she couldn't bring herself to lie to her daughter again. Maybe it was the exhaustion, or her relief that her girl was finally home, or maybe, reaching for the bulging suitcase, she knew that her daughter had running in her blood, too. She would always feel that urge to escape tugging at her and never understand why, not if Stella didn't explain it to her. Her daughter, who would forever be the only person in her life who really knew her. She gripped the suitcase handle, staring down at the worn carpet. "I gave it to my sister," she said. "She needs it more than I do." Kennedy stopped.
"Your sister," she said.
"You went back there?"
"Come on, honey," Stella said. "We can talk in the car."
Traffic would be a nightmare. She knew this long before she inched onto the 405, bumper to bumper, red taillights as far as she could see. When she'd first moved to Los Angeles, she'd found the traffic a little beautiful. All those people going places. She was frightened to drive on the freeway, but once she got the hang of it, she went for drives alone in the middle of the day for the peace of it. She liked studying the cloudless sky, the pale blue mountains up ahead. Her baby girl strapped in the back seat, babbling along with the radio.
"You can ask me what you'd like," she said, gripping the steering wheel.
"But when we get home..."
I know,
her daughter said. "I can't say anything."
"It hurts to talk about," she said. "You understand? But I want you to know me."
Her daughter turned away, glancing out the window. They weren't far from home, but this was Los Angeles. You could cover a lifetime in 11 miles. Chapter 17. They named the dead man Freddie. He was 21, 6'2", 180 pounds, the victim of an enlarged heart. In their more morbid moments, the lab called him Fred the Dead. At the University of Minnesota, all of the medical students named their cadavers. It personalized death, the faculty said. It restored dignity to the undignified process of dying. To the undignified process of science. This was what people had in mind when they imagined donating their bodies to research. A group of 20-somethings in lab coats, jokingly brainstorming names. Each year, at least one group so lazy they dubbed you Yorick and got on with it. Weirdly enough, naming Freddie made his body less intimate to Jude. It wasn't his real name. He'd lived and died a completely different man, one they would never know beyond the details inscribed on his chart. He'd barely lived at all, really. And now he would quite possibly live a more interesting life here on the slab in their basement laboratory. Once she got past the smell, Jude liked working with cadavers. She didn't have to joke about them to mask her discomfort. She never felt sick at the sight of a dead body. Lectures bored her, but she was rapt during labs, always the first to grab her scalpel when the professor asked for volunteers. People lived in bodies that were largely unknowable. Some things you could never learn about yourself. Some things nobody could learn about you until after you died. She was fascinated by the mystery of dissections, as well as the challenge. They had to search for tiny nerves that were impossible to find.
It was almost like a little treasure hunt.
That's gross, baby,
Reese said. He always squirmed away when she came home, smelling like formaldehyde. He made her shower before kissing him. He never wanted to be touched after the dead people. He'd always been more sentimental, at least she thought, until the afternoon that her mother called to tell her that her grandmother had died. She stood in her windowless office, holding the phone against her cheek. She was TAing that semester and had been given an office she rarely used. Nobody had the phone number except for Reese and her mother in case of emergencies. She'd been so startled to hear her mother's voice that it hadn't dawned on her the only reason she might be calling.
You knew she was sick, her mother said.
She was trying to comfort her, or maybe just alleviate her shock.
I know, Jude said. Still,
it wasn't painful. She was smiling and talking to me, right up until the end.
Are you all right, Mama?
Oh, you know me.
That's why I'm asking.
Her mother laughed a little. I'm fine, she said. Anyway, the service is Friday. I just wanted to let you know. I know you're busy with school.
Friday? Jude said. I'll fly down.
Hold on. No use in you coming all the way down here.
My grandmother is dead, Jude said. I'm coming home.
Her mother didn't try to dissuade her further. Jude was grateful for that. She'd already acted as if notifying her of her grandmother's passing had been some inconvenience. What type of life did her mother think she was living that she couldn't interrupt with that type of news? They hung up, and Jude stepped out into the hallway. Students buzzed past. A friend from the biology department waved his coffee at her as he ducked into the lounge. A weedy orange-haired girl tacked a green poster for a protest onto the announcement board. That was the thing about death. Only the specifics of it hurt. Death, in a general sense, was background noise. She stood in the silence of it. West Hollywood was a graveyard, Barry said the last time he'd called. Every day, a new litany of the dying. There were the men you sort of knew, like Jared, the blonde bartender at Mirage with the heavy pour. He'd wink, then tilt the bottle of gin into your glass, as if he were doing you a personal favor and didn't treat everyone to his generosity. His memorial was in Eagle Rock. There were exes or enemies like Ricardo, known as Jessica, a queen who'd beaten Barry at more balls than he would ever admit. He'd asked to be cremated, and Barry had stood along the shore at Manhattan Beach while he was scattered into the ocean. Then the men you loved. Luis had just been admitted to Good Samaritan Hospital, and when Jude called, he kept talking about how a nurse told him that Bobby Kennedy had died there.
Can you believe it? He said. I mean, a president died here.
She didn't have the heart to tell him that Bobby Kennedy was never president. He died running for office, a young man with promise.
Not that young, Barry said when she called him after. He was in his 40s.
That's not young, she said.
He didn't answer, and she wished she hadn't said anything at all. On the weekends, she attended impassioned meetings held by activists who organized petitions and letter-writing campaigns and demonstrations intended to shame the government out of its indifference. She volunteered with a student group that handed out condoms and clean needles in downtown Minneapolis. She visited patients who had no family, brought them magazines and playing cards. She thought about death constantly, and still, only on the afternoon that her grandmother died did she find herself unable to touch the cadaver. It was silly, but she couldn't even look at him. She kept imagining her grandmother lying lifeless on a slab somewhere. Mama would never donate her body to research. She would hate the idea of strangers touching her, and besides, she was a Catholic who still believed that cremation was a sin. On Judgment Day, her body would be resurrected, so she needed to keep it intact.
"Just bury me in the backyard in an old pine box," Mama used to say.
This was years ago, when her grandmother began to realize that she was sick, her memories ebbing and flowing like the tide. That whole year, Jude had read every book she could find on Alzheimer's disease. She studied the illness desperately, as if understanding it would make any difference. It didn't, of course. She was only a first-year student, and she wanted to be a cardiologist anyway. The heart was a muscle she understood. The brain baffled her. Still, she borrowed books from the medical library, reading all she could. Inside her grandmother's brain, protein fragments hardened into plaques between nerve cells. Brain tissue shrank. Cells in the hippocampus degenerated. Eventually, as the disease spread through the cerebral cortex, her grandmother would lose the ability to perform routine tasks. She would lose her judgment, control of her emotions, language. She would not be able to feed herself, recognize people, control bodily functions. She would lose her memory. She would lose herself.
"Don't you waste all that money on me," her grandmother had said. "I won't be around to see none of it."
She didn't care about the outfit she was buried in, what scripture might be engraved on the headstone, which flowers adorned her. But no cremation, absolutely not. She was adamant about that. Jude never pressed her, even though she didn't understand. If God could reassemble a decaying corpse, then why couldn't he reanimate ashes? But she didn't want to picture this either. Her grandmother burned, flecks of bone and skin swirling in an urn. She left lab early. At home, Reese stirred soup over the stove. He was shirtless, barefoot in jeans. He was always shirtless these days. You would have thought they were living in a cabana in Miami, not freezing in the north. "You're gonna catch pneumonia," she said. He smiled, shrugging.
"I just got out of the shower."
His hair was still wet, tiny beads of water dotting his shoulders. She wrapped her arms around his waist, kissing his damp back.
"My grandma died," she said.
"Jesus."
He turned to face her.
"I'm sorry, baby."
"It's okay," she said. "She's been sick."
"Still. Are you all right? How's your mama?"
"She's fine. Everyone's fine.
The funeral's Friday. I want to fly down."
"Of course. You should. Why didn't you call me?"
"I don't know. I wasn't really thinking. I couldn't even look at the cadaver. Isn't that stupid? I mean, I knew it was a dead body before. What makes today any different?"
"What do you mean?"
he said.
"Today is different.
We weren't really that close."
"Don't matter,"
he said, pulling her into a hug.
"Kin is kin."
That afternoon, in a Burbank makeup trailer, the telephone rang 7 times before the hairdresser yanked it off the hook, then shoved it at the blonde sitting in his chair.
"I'm not your personal secretary,"
he whispered loudly, handing over the phone. He didn't know why the talent, which she was, in spite of his own taste, didn't respect his time, why she was always late, why she didn't tell her stalker boyfriend or whoever kept calling to bother her later. She told him that she wasn't expecting a call, but rose to answer anyway, hair half teased in a style that would mortify her decades later when she saw grainy clips from Pacific Cove on the internet.
"Hello,"
she said.
"It's Jude," the voice said. "Your grandma died."
Stupidly, Kennedy thought first about her father's mother, who died when she was little, her first funeral. It was the "your" that threw her off, not our grandmother. Her grandmother, the one she had never met, would never meet, dead. She leaned against the counter, covering her eyes.
"Oh, Christ," she said.
The hairdresser, sensing tragedy on the other end of the line, excused himself. Finally alone, Kennedy reached for a pack of cigarettes. She'd been trying to kick the habit. Her mother finally succeeded. Now she nagged her about it all the time. Sometimes she'd told herself she'd quit cold turkey. She'd throw out every pack of cigarettes she owned. Then she'd always find loose ones hidden in her drawers, in the glove compartment of her car, tucked away for her future self. She felt like a junkie, really. Quitting was the only time she felt addicted. But she could quit later. Her grandmother had died. She deserved a cigarette, didn't she? "You should really work on your bedside manner," she said. On the other end of the line, she imagined Jude smiling. "Sorry," she said. "I didn't know any other way to put it." "How's your mom?" "Okay, I think." "Jesus, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say." "You don't have to say anything. She's your grandmother, too." "It's not the same," she said. "I didn't know her like you did." "Well, I still thought you should know." "Okay," she said. "I know." "Are you gonna tell her?" Kennedy laughed. "When do I tell her anything?" She did not tell her mother, for example, that she still talked to Jude. Not all the time, but often enough. Sometimes Kennedy called her, left messages on her answering machine. "Hey, Jude," she said every time, because she knew it drove her crazy. Sometimes Jude phoned first. Their conversations always went like this one, halting, a little combative, familiar. They never talked long, never made plans to meet, and at times the calls seemed more perfunctory than anything, like holding a finger to another's wrist to feel for a pulse. A few minutes they kept their fingers pressed there, and then they let go. They did not tell their mothers about these phone calls. They would both keep that secret to the ends of the twins' separate lives. "Maybe she'd want to know this," Jude said. "Trust me, she doesn't," Kennedy said. "You don't know her like I do." Secrets were the only language they spoke. Her mother showed her love by lying, and in turn, Kennedy did the same. She never mentioned the funeral photograph again, although she'd kept that faded picture of the twins, although she would study it the night her grandmother died and not tell a soul. "I don't know her at all," Jude said. That night, late in bed, Jude asked Reese to fly home with her. She was tracing her finger along his thick eyebrows, the beard he hadn't trimmed in so long she'd started calling him a lumberjack. He was changing, always, his jawline sharper now, his muscles firmer, the hair on his arms so thick that he couldn't walk across the carpet without shocking her. He even smelled different. She noticed every little change about him since they'd broken up, right before she moved to Minnesota. He didn't want to leave his life in Los Angeles. He didn't want to follow her to the Midwest, hanging off her like dead weight. One day, he told her, she would wake up and realize that she could do much better than him. All spring, they'd broken up slowly, one piece at a time, picking little arguments, making up, making love, and starting the whole cycle all over again. Twice, she'd almost moved in with Barry. It was better to break up now than delay the inevitable, she told herself. But each night, she slept in Reese's bed. She couldn't fall asleep anywhere else. That year, the first snow had arrived earlier than she'd expected, tiny flurries falling on Halloween. She'd stared out the window of Moose Tower, watching undergraduates scurry past in their costumes. She was thinking about her cowboy sitting on the couch in that crowded party, and again tried not to cry. But that night, she found him outside her apartment door, in a black knit cap covered in snowflakes, a canvas bag slung over his shoulder. "Goddamn," he said, "I'm so goddamn stupid sometimes. You know that?" At the university, she met a black endocrinologist willing to write Reese a prescription for testosterone. They had to scrimp each month to afford it out of pocket, but those street drugs would wreck his liver, Dr. Shayla said. She was blunt, but kind. She told Reese, scribbling onto her pad, that he reminded her of her own son. Now, lying in bed across from him, Jude kissed his closed eyelids. What do you say? She asked.
Really?
He said. You want me to? I don't think I can go back there without you. She'd fallen in love with him when she was 18. She hadn't slept a night away from him in 3 years. In a dingy New York City hotel room, she'd slowly unwrapped his bandages, holding her breath as cool air kissed his new skin. Alzheimer's disease was hereditary, which meant that Desiree would always worry about developing it. She would begin filling out crossword puzzles because she'd read in some women's magazine that brain puzzles could help prevent memory loss. You've got to exercise your brain, she would tell her daughter, just like any other muscle. Her daughter didn't have the heart to tell her that the brain was, in fact, not a muscle. She tried her best to help her with the clues, while she imagined Stella out in the world somewhere, already forgetting. Jude Winston's hometown, which had never been a town at all, no longer existed. And yet it still looked the same. She stared out the window of Early's truck, which surprised her when he'd met them in Lafayette. She still expected the El Camino.
That car's older than you, Early said, laughing. I had to junk it.
He was wearing his refinery coveralls, which also struck her, Early in a uniform. He pumped Reese's hand and pulled her into a hug, kissing her forehead. His beard scratchy like she'd remembered it.
Look at you, he said. All grown up, can't hardly believe it.
He still looked strong, even though his hair was beginning to gray, silver creeping up his sideburns, threading through his beard. When she teased him about it, he laughed, touching his chin.
I'm gonna cut it off, he said. Rather walk around baby-faced than looking like Santa Claus.
How's Mama?
She said. He wiped his forehead, pushing back his baseball cap.
Oh, she all right, he said. You know your mama. She tough. She'll push through.
I wish I'd been here, she said. But she wasn't sure if she meant that. She'd never known what to say around her grandmother anyway. But she wished she could have been there for her mother, who was never supposed to endure this alone. There were supposed to be two women comforting her grandmother at the end, one on each side of the bed, one holding each hand.
It's all right, Early said. Nothing you could have done. We're just glad to have you now.
She squeezed Reese's thigh. He squeezed hers back. He was staring out the window, lips slightly parted. She knew he missed this. Not sun-dappled beaches or frozen city sidewalks, but brown countryside rolling flat into acres of woods. The white shotgun house appeared, looking the same as she'd remembered, which seemed wrong since her grandmother would not be sitting on the porch to greet them. Her death hit in waves, not a flood, but water lapping steadily at her ankles. You could drown in 2 inches of water. Maybe grief was the same. She spent the evening helping her mother cook for the repast. Early went to finalize everything at the funeral home and brought Reese with him. She stared out the kitchen window, watching both men climb into the truck, wondering what on earth they'd find to talk about.
Y'all still happy? Her mother said. He treat you good?
Desiree wasn't looking at her, bent over the oven to pull out the tray of yams.
He loves me, Jude said.
That's not what I asked. That's 2 separate things. You think you can't ever hurt nobody you love?
Jude chopped celery for the potato salad, feeling that familiar surge of guilt. 4 years she'd known about Stella and hadn't said a word. She'd never expected that Stella would reemerge on her own, that one morning her mother would call her, fighting tears and expose her lies. She'd apologized as much as she could, but even though her mother said she forgave her, she knew that something had shifted between them. She'd grown up in her mother's eyes, no longer her daughter, but a separate woman, complete with her own secrets.
Do you think...
She paused, scraping the celery into a bowl.
Do you think Daddy loved you?
I think everybody who ever hurt me loved me, her mother said.
Do you think he loved me?
Her mother touched her cheek.
Yes, she said, but I couldn't wait around to see.
The morning of the funeral, Jude awoke in her grandmother's bed because her mother told her two unmarried people would not be sharing the same bed in her house. She was still trying to nudge them down the aisle, if a statement that obvious could be considered a nudge. She did not know that Jude and Reese had talked once or twice about marriage. They wouldn't be able to, not without a new birth certificate for Reese, but still they talked about it, the way children talk about weddings, wistfully. Her mother thought they were hip intellectuals who considered themselves too cool for marriage, which was better than her understanding just how romantic they were. Jude carried clean sheets to her old bedroom, helped Reese make the bed, not even pointing out that her mother and Early were also unmarried in the eyes of the law and the church. She couldn't fall asleep until morning. She wondered, foolishly, if she might feel her grandmother's presence somehow. But she felt nothing, and that was worse. In the hallway, she turned, pinning back her hair while Reese zipped her black dress. I could hardly sleep last night, she said, without you there. He kissed the back of her neck. He was wearing his good black suit. Her mother had asked him to help carry the casket. She'd heard them talking last night in the kitchen while she brushed her teeth. Her mother told Reese that she considered him a son, wedding or not, but she hoped at least that he wouldn't make her wait forever to become a grandmother. I'm not saying it has to be now, her mother was saying. I know y'all both busy, but someday, that's all. Before I'm old and gray and can't hardly move around. You would make a good daddy, don't you think? He was quiet a minute. I hope so, he said. Near the end of her life, Adele Veens had told Desiree stories about her childhood that were so vivid, Desiree wondered if her mother was confusing them with her soap operas. A girl she'd hated in school who tried to push her down a well. Her brothers dressed in all black to steal coal. A poor boy bringing her a carnation corsage for senior prom. She'd bring up one of these anecdotes in front of the television, where she sat watching her soaps each afternoon. The shows seemed like the perfect form for her. Each day, the story's inching forward, but at the end of the week, the world essentially unchanged, the characters exactly who they had always been. The first time her mother called her Stella, Desiree had just helped her into her chair. She was searching for the remote in the couch cushions, but stopped suddenly. What? She said. What did you call me? She was so confused that she'd sputtered. It's me, Mama. Desiree. Of course, her mother said. That's what I meant. She seemed embarrassed by the slip-up, as if it had only been poor manners. Dr. Brenner told them not to correct her mistakes. She said what she believed in her mind to be true. Correcting her would only agitate or confuse her. And normally, Desiree didn't. Not when her mother called Early Leon. Not when she forgot the names for ordinary things. Pan, pin, chair. But how could her mother forget her? The daughter who'd lived with her for the past 20 years. The one who cooked her meals, eased her into the bathtub, slowly administered her pills. Dr. Brenner said that was the nature of the disease. The far stuff,
They remember, he said. Nobody knows why. It's like they're living their lives backward.
Here was the backward story. The present and its tedium receding. All those doctor visits, the endless pills, the strange man shining lights in her eyes, the television programs she could never follow, the daughter watching her, rising each time Adele lifted out of her chair, any time Adele tried to go anywhere. She found herself in the strangest places. She went out to take a walk and fell asleep in a field for hours until the daughter, crying, wrapped her in a blanket and brought her home. She was a baby, maybe. The girl was her mother, or her sister. Her face switched each time Adele looked at her. Once there had been two, or maybe there still was. Maybe every time she closed her eyes, a new one appeared. She only remembered the name of one, Stella. Starlight, burning and distant.
Where did you go, Stella?
She asked once. This was toward the end, or rather the beginning. She was waiting for Leon to come home from the store. He had promised her daffodils. Stella was sitting next to her, rubbing a powdery lotion into her hands.
Nowhere, Mama, she said.
She wouldn't look at her.
I've been here the whole time. You did, Adele said. You went somewhere.
But she couldn't think of where. Stella climbed into bed with her, wrapping her arms around her.
No, she said. I never left.
Desiree Veen's up and left Mallard, people would say, as if there were anything abrupt about her departure. No one had expected her to stay past a year. She'd remained for almost 20. Then her mother died, and she decided finally that she'd had enough. Maybe she couldn't live in her childhood house after losing both her parents, although their final moments could not have been more different. Her father died in the hospital, staring into the faces of his killers. Her mother had simply gone to sleep and not woken up. She might have still been dreaming. But it wasn't only the memories that pushed her out. She was thinking instead of the future. For once in her life, looking forward. So after she buried her mother, she sold the house, and she and Early moved to Houston. He found a job at the Conoco refinery, and she worked at a call center. She had not worked in an office in 30 years. Her first morning, she shivered under the air conditioning as she reached for the phone, trying to remember her script. But her supervisor, a 30-something blonde girl, told her that she was doing a fine job. She stared at her desk, shadowed by the praise.
I don't know, she told her daughter. It just seemed like time to move on.
But you like it there?
It's different. The traffic, the noise, all the people. It's been a while, you know, since I've been around so many people.
I know, Mama. But you like it?
Sometimes I think I should have left sooner. For you and for me. We could have been anywhere. I could have been like Stella. Lived a big life.
I'm glad you're not like her, her daughter said.
I'm glad I ended up with you.
At the call center, she sat down each morning to dial the lists of phone numbers. It wasn't easy work, her young supervisor told her on her first day. You have to be okay with rejection, people hanging up on you, cursing you out.
Won't be worse than nothing folks have said to my face, she said,
and the supervisor laughed. She liked Desiree. All the young girls did. Called her Mama D. After her first week, she'd memorized the script, reciting it to herself when she sat on the bench outside the office, waiting for Early to pick her up.
Hello, name. You were always supposed to personalize it. My name is Desiree Veens with Royal Travel here in Houston. As a seasonal promotion, we're giving away 3 days and 2 nights of hotel accommodations in the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington metropolitan area.
Now, I'm sure you're thinking, what's the catch, right?
She always paused here, laughing a little, which either endeared her to the caller or gave him an opportunity to hang up. She was surprised by how often they stayed on the line.
You got a sweet little voice,
Early told her once, grinning at her across their porch. But what seemed more likely is that people were lonely. Sometimes she imagined cold calling Stella. Would she recognize her voice? Would it still sound like her own? Or would Stella sound like a lonely person who wanted her to keep talking just to hear another voice on the line? Adele Veens was buried on the colored side of St. Paul's Cemetery. Nobody expected any different. This was the way it had always been, the white folks in the north side, the colored folks in the south. Nobody complained until the year the Eucharistic ministers at the white church that owned the cemetery cleaned tombstones for All Souls Day, but only on the north side. When Mallard protested, the deacon did not want to fight, so he dispatched two grumbling altar boys with sloshing buckets to scrub the headstones on the colored side, too. Jude almost laughed when her mother had told her. That was the solution. Not desegregating the graveyard, just cleaning the headstones on both sides. A strong hurricane could flood the cemetery, the old caskets swinging open, filling with brown water, some grave digger rooting through the mud for gold watches and diamond rings, marveling over his good fortune, would step over bones, not knowing the difference. At the cemetery, she watched Reese lift her grandmother, Early lined up across from him, four other pallbearers behind. Across the open earth, the priest blessed the body, his hand tracing the sign of the cross through the air, and like that, her grandmother was lowered into the earth. She rubbed her mother's back, hoping that she wouldn't turn around. She couldn't look at her face, not right now. During the service, she'd held her hand, imagining another woman sitting in that pew, Stella, worrying her fingers along a strand of rosary beads, joining her sister in silent grief. At the repast, the town gathered inside Adele Veens' house, hoping to catch a glimpse of Mallard's lost daughter. She was in medical school now, they'd heard from her mother. Half the room expected her to walk in wearing a white coat. The other half was skeptical, figuring that Desiree Veens was exaggerating. How could that dark girl have done all those things Desiree said? But they did not find her amongst the dead. She had slipped out the back door with her boyfriend, holding his hand as they ran through the woods toward the river. The sun was beginning to set, and under the tangerine sky, Reese tugged his undershirt over his head. The sun warmed his chest, still paler than the rest of them. In time, his scars would fade, his skin darkening. She would look at him and forget that there had ever been a time he'd hidden from her. He unzipped her funeral dress, folding it neatly on a rock, and they waded into the cold water, squealing, water inching up their thighs. This river, like all rivers, remembered its course. They floated under the leafy canopy of trees, begging to forget. This is Shayna Small. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. This program was directed by Joseph Grimm. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2020 by Brittany Bennett. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.